Welcome to the Borderless Podcast, your guide to traveling, investing, and living beyond borders, where we talk about living the life that you want to live, where you want to live it.
All right, everybody, welcome to another Borderless Podcast. This is your host, James Guzman. Thanks for tuning in. Today, I have an interview that I was actually interviewed on a podcast that's called Unconstrained, and so I'll play that for you. First, I wanted to go over something that I thought was interesting. It has to do a lot with people that are traveling and living a borderless lifestyle. And what I see now is there is more competition from different governments that want to attract people. And I think this is a trend that we're going to see more of, and I think that is very positive. So some of the things that specifically can show that is, I don't know if you have seen that Barbados is now offering a digital nomad visa. All that you have to do is show that you can make, I believe, around $3,000 or more. And if you work remotely, they want you over there, and you can get a full visa to live there. And also Estonia has just announced that they're doing something similar. I think it's kind of funny with Barbados, because I actually got kicked out of Barbados for that because they didn't want to give me a visa. You know, I said that I didn't want a job there, and they said, well, how are you going to live? I said, well, I have money. I don't need a job. And they said, well, no, you have to get a job here. And so, you know, basically they made me leave, and I went to St. Vincent instead. But now they are offering that. So this is one of the first countries that's offering this kind of visa. And another thing I kind of wanted to tie into that, I just saw a commercial from North Dakota, and they have not done any types of lockdowns with COVID and very little tax. And so they have a new commercial about that, you know, please move to North Dakota and all this. And so I kind of wanted to relate that with the work visas. So, you know, of course, they have different things that people want. That these individual places want for you to move there, and they're trying to attract different types of people. But I think overall this trend is positive, and I think this is something that we're going to see and we should support. You know, we want different areas to compete and, you know, have to, you know, that they can't just treat their citizenry like livestock and that they're never going to leave. Then now we have more remote options and people are more mobile than ever, so they can actually choose where to go, because of the weather, because of how they're treated. And so because of that, governments are going to have to be more hospitable, and it'll be some more competition. And I see this as a trend in the future. I think this is going to be good. So I will send out a link if anybody's interested in the details of the Barbados or the Estonia thing. Also, you can get a visa, but also there's a lot of places that are still open for travel normally. I know here in Mexico has not shut down ever. You've been able to fly in the whole time. They do have that, and so you can still be traveling and working. I know many people are still doing that. And so I will link the information there and send that out in the email list. If you're not on the email list, please go to borderlessblog.com and sign up for that. I will play this interview that I did. It's a friend of mine. His name is Miles, and he has a podcast called Unconstrained. Kind of similar theme to Borderless Podcast. We talked about life here and comparing it to the U.S. and other types of things like that. So I hope that you enjoy that, and I will talk to you soon. Borderless.
We are continuing our journey down the mini-series called Get Out of Dodge, where you can find opportunities and thrive outside of your local area, particularly international travel. And on today's show, I'm speaking with a friend of mine, James Guzman, from San Miguel de Allende in Mexico. James is going to tell you his story about how he left the United States and how he found his opportunities and how he found his success outside of the USA and what life is like living in Mexico. So let's enjoy.
Welcome to the Unconstrained Podcast, your regular podcast on how to escape the chains of the 21st century, become financially independent, and live a global lifestyle. Now, here's your host, Miles Wakeham.
Welcome to the Unconstrained Podcast. I am your host, Miles Wakeham. This is a show about how to live a life of freedom without the shackles of debt by embracing the art of contrarian thinking. Well, I'm recording this on July the 4th, normally a day of independence, a day of celebration, fireworks and so on. But unusual situation for me because I found out this week that I have COVID-19. I guess it's nothing really unusual these days because apparently somebody told me one in four people in Arizona have it, and I guess I'm just part of the statistic. But thankfully, I was one of the 80% of people who had a very mild case. So although I don't want to actually go and explain the whole process of what it's like to have this thing, because I honestly wouldn't wish it on anybody, I will say that I'm fine and, you know, I'm in my recovery. At this point, I think I'm about day 12 since I discovered that I thought I had it. But what was more interesting was to come face-to-face with what I can only suggest is a societal collapse in the United States, where the things that you normally would expect that you can rely on kind of aren't there. So what do I mean by that? Well, the first thing is, you know, we're all fixated by our media telling us all these war stories about COVID-19 and how people are dying and the daily statistics in your region and how many people are in hospital. They don't tell you how many people recover, by the way, which is an unusually interesting statistic. Most people do. I mean, the vast, vast, vast majority of people recover from this. The actual death rate is very small. But the truth is that what they're not telling you is the whole story, and that is if you think you've got it, well, good luck finding that out, because getting a test is not as easy as it would normally seem, no matter what your politicians might want to tell you. And my own personal experience mirrors that. So just so I can kind of give you some of the general sort of high-level points about what this disease is like, I think I got mine going to the gym, although I cannot tell. I have a gym that I go to regularly, and it's extremely well sanitized. It's very, very clean. And I usually go at nighttime when there's very few people in the gym. In fact, I think at the time I was there, maybe five people were in the gym. And I'll typically go up the back and work out on treadmills and do cardio up there. So I typically am away from a lot of people. So there's no doubt that I was social distancing myself. But of course, you know, how do you run on a treadmill with a mask on? It's next to impossible. So, of course, I didn't do that. But I don't think that was actually the issue. I don't know exactly how this came about. All I know was a day or so later, I started to get the signs like I had the flu. I'm sort of like a brain fog, that head cold thing. And, you know, I've had many a flu in my time. So I know what this process feels like. And it felt just like I was getting the flu. Well, this was in June of 2020 in Arizona, where the average outdoor temperature was 105 degrees every day. It's not the time that the flu is rampant in this area. So I thought this is really unusual. Didn't really have a fever, although I did have a slight elevated temperature. Nothing major, but the sort of thing that, you know, a couple of Excedrin could keep under wraps. So I did that, went to bed, didn't think much about it. Well, next day it was worse. It wasn't bad, like it wasn't crazy debilitating, but the brain fog was pretty severe. And I started realizing that I got these sort of body aches and so on, and they weren't overly severe again. It was just something that you just wanted to rest a bit. So I did, thinking, oh, well, maybe I've got some sort of a virus. But in trying to research, do I have this thing? Am I subjected to something? Is there a protocol? There are no answers out there. You spend all your time watching TV, and when you get at politicians and people trying to go against mask wearing and all that sort of thing, and you wonder, well, if you knew all the answers, then I would have a protocol to follow, but clearly there wasn't any. So, you know, I go to YouTube, and what I find is actually there's a lot of really good videos out there, particularly from Britain, on the process of diagnosing and treating this thing. And I started to see some noteworthy signs. I think one of the things that people were telling me was going to be a telltale sign of this was if you lose your taste or your sense of smell. I hadn't really lost that yet, but what I did notice was my appetite was down. So I don't know, maybe that was just the way it manifested for me. But at this point in time, I'm not coughing up a lung or anything like that. Things are just this head cold, this brain fog. And that went on for a couple of days. So eventually I got some antibiotics and I took that and surprisingly it went away. I thought, oh, I've just got myself some sort of a virus here, some bacterial infection of some sort, and the antibiotics have taken care of it. So, you know, I went through the normal 6 days of antibiotic process and it was manageable, wasn't that bad, but it hadn't really moved into anything else. So by the end of the 6 days, I thought, well, I'm probably over this thing, you know. Of course it wasn't. What ended up happening was I started to get the coughs. They weren't bad and they were not dry coughs. They were productive. So it wasn't like I had a big deal dealing with this sort of thing, but I had to deal with it. And to this day, I still have minor coughs, but my energy levels were way down, way down. And that's where it starts getting stressful. The things that I could normally have done in my general everyday, you know, activities, releasing podcasts and videos and writing articles, not so much. You know, I just didn't have that energy level. And eventually, yes, I did manage to get that back. But it took time. It took days. And even today, which I guess is now day 13, since I noticed the first signs, my energy levels are about 75% what they normally would be. You know, I've been in isolation since I noticed this. I haven't gone out of the house. Everything has been pretty much locked down for me. Not that really that was any different than what it was before, but in this case, I've even further isolated. Thankfully, none of my family have got this thing. They did not get exposed to it. It appears like it was only contagious in the first maybe 2 to 5 days of having it, although, again, there are no answers. But here's the thing that's really scary. You know, when you go through this thing, you know that you'll get over it. You know you'll get through the end of it. And I feel very sorry for people who have got it really bad and, you know, are dealing with hospitalization or ICUs and things like that, because that's horrible. And the reality is we as individuals don't know. We have very little control over whether you're going to get a mild case or whether you're going to get a hardcore case. Thankfully, 80% of us will get a mild case, and I was one of those 80%. But, man, if you got this thing hardcore, here's the reality here in Arizona. We are in a state of complete chaos, and that really is concerning to me. You know, my podcast, as you well know, listening to me, it's all about being unconstrained, being free. But I'm a realist. How are you free if we're in a time of war? How are you free if we're in a time of pandemic? How are you free if there's bushfires ravaging everything around you? Do you want to just sit there and pretend it's not happening and go, well, I'm free, so therefore I don't need to do the appropriate things here to protect myself? Well, that's just stupid. So there's a difference between being a free, independent, you know, American constitutionalist, I'm not going to wear a mask and, you know, I'm bigger than this and how dare you keep me down. There's that versus I'm going to stand in the middle of the road and be run over by a steamroller. Okay, you make a choice. Personally, I think there's a pragmatic reality here, and the reality is this is a real disease. I've got it or I've had it. I know how this feels. And I got a minimal case of it. It's real. So having said that, would it not be better to try to reduce the number of people who are taking up all those hospital beds? Because God forbid the day comes and you need that hospital bed and some doctor or some counsel on the hospital says, I'm sorry, you don't get a bed because you don't fit the profile of the most likely survivable candidate for the bed. Is that a situation? Because we today have the power to make that, to influence that. We've never seen that level of what they call in here in Arizona, they call it red line rationing, where the doctors and the hospitals are choosing who survives and who dies. But we are now seeing that. You see, I think of that as what I call societal collapse. where society cannot look after your ability to maintain a life. That the things that you relied on, having a hospital there if God forbid you needed it, being able to go to the ER, they're off the table right now. You know, there was a time recently when we had riots here where we were being told, if you have some sort of maybe a property crime, someone's breaking into your car or into your home, don't try and call the police. There's no point because they won't come. They don't want to be exposed to any particular virus. And unless there's a victim involved in this crime, like a human being beaten up, murdered, attacked, raped, whatever, they don't want to attend the situation. Now, I personally, thank God, never was in a situation where I needed to call them to test that theory. But if that's the effect of society, that there's no police there you can rely on, so you need to take up arms and look after yourself and protect your own family, that's a part of societal collapse. Another part of societal collapse is there is no hospital with a bed for you, so you cannot go to the hospital. Okay, that's collapsed. Here's another part. If there's no school open for your kid, because schools can't afford the risk of the disease perpetuating throughout the school and the kids getting it. So now you're forced to homeschool. That's another part of societal collapse. All the things that we as individuals in the Western world, in the middle class, we pay our taxes. This is what we pay for. All gone. They're not there. Now, okay, granted, it's a small little piece of time, right? But this is what societal collapse looks like. What other things can cause societal collapse other than a pandemic? Well, a war. If we were being attacked, then we would probably have the same thing. You'd give away all of those resources in order to support the troops, in order to support the front line. We saw this happen in World War II. And I'm sure in other times in history, this is what happens when society requires you to give up all of these things and direct it towards wartime effort, because you do not want to lose that war and lose your freedoms, right? So a small delay of giving it up now in order to get them back later, it makes sense and everybody's on board with it. But today they're not all on board with it. Today, even our ultimate highest leaders are telling society by their actions and by their words that they do not need to wear masks. They do not need to reduce the risk and reduce the bed occupancy. See, I don't care about whether you think of this as being an independence thing against your own very constitutional rights. I don't care about that, because at the end of the day, if my neighbor who's 60 years old gets sick and can't get a bed in a hospital and dies, that's on you. It's not his fault he got sick, but it sure as hell's your fault if you went there and you took up a bed because you're younger and you are more survivable because you were being an arrogant idiot and not wearing a mask or not taking precaution, not washing your hands, not doing the basic things that, you know, any dumb idiot would do. If you're that person and you think this is not going to ever happen to me, well, let me tell you, as somebody who is fiercely independent and has a goal of being fiercely unconstrained, you're a bleeding idiot, because we all can get this thing, and I'm proof of that. So now, having been through that process, I want to try to send the message out, and I know people are going to be hating what I'm telling you in some cases. If you haven't had this thing yet, and you don't think you're ever going to get it, you think you're invincible, and you think that affords you the right of being a non-mask-wearing citizen out there and that this is your constitutional right of freedom, you don't have the right to take a bed away from somebody who is sick with it. You don't have that right. If this was a time of war and everybody was about to be attacked by the enemy, do you think you would stand up defiant against your own government who says you must give up in order for the greater good and the greater freedom of your country? Do you think that you would be that person? Because if you are, they call you a traitor. They don't call you somebody who supports the better good. You're a problem. Now, I know I'm being harsh, But I want people to understand that this is real. And I want people to understand that all it takes is a small inconvenience to make sure you go out there and just wear a mask, wash your hands, keep your distance from people. Don't go out in public if you don't need to. Right? It's no reason. It's not. No one's threatening your independence here. All we're saying is we don't have enough beds, and we need to have beds available for people like your grandparents and your parents and your aunties and your uncles and your godparents. They need a bed. And being arrogant and taking away their ability to get a bed and potentially their ability to survive this thing is just the ultimate form of dumb arrogance. So I want to leave you with that message. I know, I'm sorry, it's not a positive message of optimism and so on, but it is the reality of what we're living with right now. It's shitty for everybody right now. Trust me, I've been through this. I know what it feels like. I don't know what it feels like on an ICU bed and a ventilator. I don't know what it feels like for 4 weeks being in that. I have no idea what those poor people who have gone through this, what their financial situation is going to look like 3 months from now if they survive it. I do feel very scared that our society has spent money it doesn't have, and I worry whether or not it will have the resources a year or two or 5 years from now to be able to function as a real society. That scares me. But the one thing I'm not the person to do is to stand up in defiance in the middle of the freeway while oncoming traffic is coming upon me going, you don't have the right to take away my freedoms, while I'm watching a semi-trailer mow me down in the middle of the road. And that's the situation it seems like right now. So having said that, I know I'm going to get flack from people who don't necessarily agree with this, but trust me, I got this thing. I think I'm just about over it, thank God. But I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but I sure would not want to take away a hospital bed from somebody who cops it really bad, because that's, I've got blood on my hands if I do that, and that's not right. All right, having said that, I'm going to get on now to the subject of our discussion for today's show, and that is my interview with my friend James Guzman down in San Miguel de Allende in Mexico. And James is going to tell you about his experiences of what drove him out of the US and where he found his opportunities down south. So after this short message, let's hear from James. Let's begin.
Would you like to support the show? How about joining our community at Patreon? You can find a link to it on beunconstrained.com/Patreon. You can also contribute using Bitcoin over at float.app. That's FLOTE.APP. Where we can be found as at Be Unconstrained. Your contributions to the show are greatly appreciated at any level. Let's make this community and the message of financial sustainability stronger together.
Well, on today's show, I am delighted to have a friend of mine, James Guzman, who's going to tell you all about his story, his journey, and what it's like to be borderless. So welcome to the show, James.
Thanks, Miles. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's hear about your story because it's really interesting and I think my listeners are going to want to hear this one.
Wow. Well, I started out, I was born in San Diego, but very quickly I moved to the East Coast. I was raised on the East Coast between Virginia and North Carolina. And to make a long story short, when I got out of high school, I joined the Navy. And I just didn't have a whole lot of other stuff going for me. I thought that I needed to go to college, and my parents didn't have any money to pay for my college. So I figured I'd get the GI Bill. I could see some of the world. And I thought at the time, this is a way for me to, be patriotic and give to my country at the same time. And so I did that. And after 3 years or, something of that, I was just, I wasn't really for my personality type. So It came to be obvious that I was not going to continue on with that. And that's a long story also, but so I got out after my 4 years, and I went to, before that, I'd like to say that during that time period, I borrowed a lot of money, because this was also in the early 2000s or mid 2000s, when they were giving out easy money, especially to people with jobs like in the military. So I got a VA loan, first loan ever when I was 20 years old, 0% down, 3% interest. So I was paying $560 a month for, and I believe it was, I bought it for $65,000 for a condo on the beach in Virginia Beach.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then I rented out one of my rooms and for $400. So I was only paying $160 a month when I was 21, something like that. And I had a whole condo at the beach. I had it appraised maybe three years after I bought it, and it pretty much doubled in value, and from only paying $160 a month, right? So I had read Kiyosaki's stuff and all this, and I was like, wow, this is it. This is how you just buy real estate and sit on it and you get rich. That's it, you know? And so I doubled down. I actually, instead of taking the money out in 2006, I doubled down and I got more rental properties. And so then at right about the beginning of 2008, I did not want to be in the Navy anymore. I was fed up with that. I actually got married very young. And so at that time, the marriage was not working out. And also, the crash hit.
Right.
And so it was all these three things hitting me at once. I was in a lot of debt, like a lot of people at that time. And so I decided I had pretty much a perfect credit score. And so that was when I was 23, 24 years old. I can't remember exactly. And I decided to do just a strategic default. I'm just going to mail the keys into all my properties and everything, and I'm going to leave the country. And so I used my GI Bill, and I went to a pretty good university in Spain. For a lot of people that have access to a GI Bill, whether their parents, sometimes it can be passed down to a spouse, to a child or something like that. If you think you might have access to it, I would definitely look into it if you want to go into a field that is going to be useful to, that you want to have. There's not very many, but there are definitely some where you need to go to to university to get in a certain field. That's a great resource. Once you get accepted to a school, they will pay for the whole thing now. For the post 9/11 GI Bill, they'll pay for internet, the most expensive school, as long as you get accepted. So if you've decided to go down the path of university, you definitely want to look into that. So I did that. That was a great experience. Just being in Europe in general, learning all the history while I was there and all that. I got to study also with Jesus Huerta de Soto, who is a pretty prominent economist, and he has a PhD program. He teaches free market and Austrian PhD program there in Madrid. He was a direct student of Rothbard. So that was great. Got to listen to a lot of his lectures, and I did my whole degree under David Howden, who's a student of his. And I also went to the Mises Institute and studied some more economics, politics, and stuff like that. And then after that, I got my first job with, the only thing I wanted to do was work for Peter Schiff, because he had really changed so much of my thinking. And so I hammered Peter Schiff with emails. I went to Schiff Gold, and I did all that I could do. I called into his radio station and I asked him some question. And at the end of it, I said, hey, by the way, can I get a job with you or something like that? And, finally, I mailed in my resume to the producer or whatever of his radio show, and his partner got a hold of it, and I did get hired as a broker. That was my first job out of college. I went to Barbados, and I was pretty much a commodities broker, selling gold and other type of commodities, funds, and things like that. From there, I kind of felt restricted in the amount of things that I could offer. And so I wanted to branch out a little bit. I ended up going to Acapulco, where I could continue to do financial sales. And also I did some real estate sales. I helped people that wanted to relocate to Acapulco or Mexico in general, mm-hmm. and buy real estate there. So I did that for years. Wrote for the financial newsletter, Dollar Vigilante. Mm-hmm. And then I decided I wanted to leave that and go on my own. And so I moved to San Miguel de Allende, which is a completely different vibe. It's in the center of Mexico than Acapulco, I mean. And it's a colonial town, beautiful, very tranquil. Things work well. Lots of good restaurants, fresh food, and good cost of living. And so here I've been doing real estate sales, online marketing, and just finding all kinds of different ways to make a living. And I talk about that on my blog and podcast. So
wonderful. So interesting comparisons between different places there. If you were to A/B life in San Miguel as opposed to life in where in the States, in Virginia, for example, what do you see as the differences?
Yeah, well, there's definitely a lot of differences. I'm not the type that just want to throw everything in the States and say that it's bad. I mean, there are some things that I would say are pros and cons about every different type of place. There's what kind of freedom, what kind of life that you value more. Here, you know, I think one of the first things people think about, one of the real reasons that people usually come down to Latin America is the economics of it, you know, financially. So I would probably say that living here compared to Virginia, you're going to spend about 1/4 of what you would there overall. You get, and another thing is just the general quality of life. You know, one thing that I talked about is a lot of the food. You get a lot of fresh food. It's very kind of decentralized, which is one thing that's been great during this COVID thing, because you see, you know, there's been a lot of problems with, you know, meat and different types of things that they're talking about distribution. Here in Mexico, it's already very decentralized. Most of all of the local, what they call frutarias, which is just the vegetable tiendas, shops and stuff, and the carnicerias or the butchers, they're all from local places, all of them. And I don't know how that could happen, that there would be some kind of a breakdown in distribution, because it's not kind of centralized like that. You know, I just think about it in North Carolina or Virginia. Normally you have one grocery store, right? Whether it's, you know, in North Carolina, it's Harris Teeter, Food Lion, whatever, you know, if you don't have that, or maybe you have two or three options, but if you don't have that one place, and if there's, you know, if there's no meat there, for instance, then you're screwed. There's no meat anywhere, right? Here, there's a lot of different options and they come from a lot of different places, and they're very, very expensive comparatively. So that's one of the plus. I would say that getting business done in general is going to be a challenge to a lot of, you know, especially like hard chargers. You want to come and you want to set up a business here. You have to get used to a different pace of life, a different style. It's just not going to work the same. I mean, if you go to a big city like Mexico City or something, or Medellin, or Monterrey, and those are big cities where they do have a lot of business. But for the most part, it's going to be a lot slower paced. You're not going to, you know, it's going to be harder to get the type of results that you might come to expect. People are going to be a lot less motivated than you are used to if you're in a U.S. city. Overall, I think that especially where I am in San Miguel, you know, the air is great. It's quality of life in general. People are friendly, so I find the restaurants to be great. There's a good mix of there's a lot of expats from different places, and they mix in well with the local culture. There's really not animosity about that. So overall, that's what I would say.
Now, there's a sense of sort of giving back there too, right? I mean, the expats and the local communities just synergistic. It works
big
very
time,
well.
Yeah, big time. There's a lot of NGOs and that help out the community, food banks and other things that help out even out in the campos, the really areas. There's over 100 NGOs set up, and it is a lot of expats that are bringing down their money that come to give back. And so that, yeah, it's a nice thing.
That's
a lot of, and a lot of the locals appreciate that.
Yeah. And that, I think that's part of the fact that, I mean, there's always that concern that people have who leave the place of their birth and then go to somewhere else, that they feel that possibly they'd be ostracized, or they become the minority in that area. But I didn't experience that myself when I was in Mexico, particularly in San Miguel. It was a much more integrated community. Everybody got along with everybody. It was amazing how that worked.
I would say my story is a little bit different because I am Latino and I already spoke Spanish. So it's a little easier for me to kind of fit in. If I don't open my mouth, then a lot of people think I'm from here. I'm sure that my experience has been a little bit different, but I wouldn't be too worried about it, especially in San Miguel, because there's a long history of expats down here for a variety of reasons. But I would say, especially unless you make that effort to fit in, to learn the language, to try to get involved in the community, then expect to be to be fully integrated. It's possible, but it's going to take a while.
Right.
Like I'm engaged to a Mexican woman and we speak Spanish all the time and with a lot of Mexican people. And I'm pretty integrated, but I'm still not 100%. Maybe I would be in, like 10 years or something. But so, that's something to keep in mind.
All right. So I have to touch upon this because it's such a ridiculously marketed concept. Let's talk about danger, because my experience is there isn't any, but what do you think in terms of things like, drug cartels and all the stuff that the nightly news over here would love to sensationalize? What's the reality on the ground there?
Yeah, as far as danger, there was about a year ago, there was kind of a flare-up between two gangs around, in Mexico. I'm sure a lot of people would remember, and it was in the news a lot. And there was that going on. That's died down now. But there are, sometimes, the numbers, about people getting shot and that kind of thing or killed. Those things do happen. Normally this is gang on gang violence. It happens in areas that you're probably not going to be hanging out, or you probably shouldn't be hanging out in. to be honest with you, even during last year when it seemed like it was spiking up a little bit, the people that I hang out with are we didn't really change. It didn't affect our lives in any way. Jonathan and I, who was a co-host of the Borderless podcast before, we did an interview together on about this topic about a year ago when we got contacted by a friend of ours who also has a podcast, and he says, "What is going on? Are you guys okay?" And we're like, "Yeah, nothing's really affecting us here. There are things going on, and that's unfortunate, but doesn't really affect our life that much. So, just kind of keep your stay in, don't go into bad areas, and keep your wits about you, and things like that. But I used to get my car robbed and things like that in the States. I think I had my car robbed, three times at least. There are places where if you go, especially at night, then you're probably going to have some trouble. If you go to certain areas, certain clubs. So, use your head, the same way.
Yeah. I think that's good advice. At the end of the day, the problems around, I think it's easier to look outside of your own area and criticize it for whatever you want to make that narrative look like. Right now, it's obviously something where it's pretty hard for people to do that without looking at themselves as well, because lawlessness and rioting and all of the things that we've been dealing with, particularly in the last few weeks, is at a level that is, I've never seen it. And I've been in the States for 25 years, and I've never seen anything like this before. The fact that if you're there is a sense of, and this is kind of just, more of a US narrative, but it plays into how life is compared to Mexico. There's a very large divide between haves and have nots here, as there has been for many years, but it's never been as bad today that I've ever seen. A lot of it is due to mismanagement by Federal Reserve and money that's being tried to be disseminated out to try to bring an equilibrium between those that have and those that have not, and they're unsuccessful, as government typically is. It just is inept at being able to do that. So the money being released is being used by large corporations to not rehire their workforce, but to shore up their share price and inject the money back into the stock markets. So consequently, what's happening is the people aren't getting it, and now the people are rioting. And they're not necessarily doing it under the pretense that, you know, it's income inequality. It's what it is opportunity inequality, whether by the colour of your skin or by some sort of a tribal group that you may belong to, whether you choose to, or it's just because of your factor of your birth. The equality factor here is just really out of whack. And
yeah,
it's very easy for me to sort of poo-poo that from inside the States right now, but it drives people to want to look outside to escape it. And even if you live in a reasonably decent middle class, you know, affluent neighborhood, you're going to see banter on social media about people coming and down your street and wanting to burn your house to the ground and shoot up the neighborhood. And that I've never seen before. Yeah. But this is happening. We've seen it here, even in Scottsdale, Arizona. You know, my daughter keeps showing me posts that she's picking up on social media of these sort of intentions. And meanwhile, the local mall here got completely destroyed and looted, to the point where they had to literally bring out the National Guard and you know, armored Humvees out the front to stop people from going to the mall. Yep. It's pretty sick. Now, that is an outlier. Well, it's not a norm.
And I'd also like to mention, you know, that another difference, we're talking about differences. One difference that I like a lot is that almost everywhere outside the United States, you don't have people glued to the TV and the news all the time.
Right.
This is one of the big differences. It seems like when I go back to the States, it's very noticeable everywhere you go, whether it's the airport or the bus station or your doctor's office or when you go to eat breakfast or whatever, they've got TV screens with sports or news or some kind of propaganda or something on all the time. And people are, you know, I don't know another word, but are, you know, under mind control.
For this. Yeah, it is. Yes, it's hypnotism.
All this craziness that you see, I think, is a lot to do with that. They're, you know, it's like 1984. They flip. Oh no, this is the enemy now. No, this is the enemy now. No, we got to do. And it's whatever the media wants to steer people to do. And you don't see that almost anywhere in the world. But like here, there people would not. It's just a general attitude. If you put a big, you know, a TV screen in a restaurant, people, what are you doing? Why, you know, that was, they just wouldn't like that. That's not what, you know, it's so it would just be a weird thing. It would be a weird thing. And it's also, more cohesive, and more cohesive here in that, I mean, you have, you know, people that, born and raised here and, you know, you have Mexican people and they have, Mexican food and things like this. And it's not kind of different. I think that's one of the things that has come out of kind of the very, consumerist and what you call like multicultural United States is that you have a lot of people with very, very conflicting values and histories and all this type of stuff kind of vying for power over the state to, they want to implement it on each other. And that's what you see is people that are very different value systems that are just, since we have this overarching state, that they're just trying to wield the state on the other people. And so that when you have kind of a more cohesive, you know, community or society, you know, you don't have so much of that conflict, I think.
I think the other thing which is kind of interesting is that there's this opportunity right now which is opening up, and, you know, thankfully because of the internet, but it's the opportunity where people can be working remotely and earning their income from a remote location. And the natural inclination would be that people just work from home, but in fact, there's no reason why they couldn't be domiciled in a lower cost of living environment, such as Mexico, and still be within reasonable time zone difference to their employer, and yet their employer can't have them in the office because right now we've got coronavirus. But at the same time, even if they chose to have them back, it would be to their advantage to continue to perpetuate this remote worker paradigm. And as long as they're available, there's absolutely no reason why they have to be in the United States. Are you finding people in San Miguel, for example, who are doing work for companies in the States but being located there?
There are some. Most of the expats here are retired. Just, I think it just has to do with the, most younger people or entrepreneurial people, when they go to Mexico, they want to go to the beach. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't want to go to a mountain colonial town, kind of, you know, laid back. Maybe they'd visit, but that's not where they want to live. They'd rather go to Playa del Carmen, Puerto Vallarta, mm-hmm. Something like that. So most of the people here are retired. There are some people that do run businesses or have remote jobs. Yeah, for sure. Another thing I wanted to say is that I have, there's a book. It's by Marbury. He wrote a series of books for homeschooling his kids. And the last one is called The Clippership Strategy. And I would really recommend that, you know, if people are interested in this type of thing. This was written decades ago, but he talks about making money in areas where there's money being injected. Mm-hmm. Okay, so make money from people, like you were just talking about the Federal Reserve. Well, right now they just had the biggest, you know, bailout, robbery, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. in history. And so those people have a lot of money at this point. There's going to be a point where that trickles down and we're going to get inflation, right?
Right.
But that, you know, there are people that have money at this point, and there's areas that have more money and less. So if there's a way that you can market to areas where they get the money and then live in areas that are what he calls in the book, he calls sinkholes, which is basically, you know, areas where a lot of the money doesn't get to. And so the cost of living is very low. So, you know, back then he was talking about subscriptions, magazine subscriptions to people in cities and all these types of things. He goes through some examples. But you can use that same strategy today, just, you know, trying to market yourself in areas where people make a lot of money and live in an area where it's a low cost of living. You know, also the geo arbitrage that Tim Ferriss talked about. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that's a very a good strategy to think about, especially in today's world where everything is going online. Everything is quickly, you know, becoming remote. And so it makes this strategy even easier.
Yeah, it might be that, in fact, the world of commerce and business is done online, that at least 75% of it is done online. And as a result of that, then where you are, your physical location, is less relevant to your business location. That if you have a website, you have a presence on the internet, maybe you can choose where you want to bank, where you want to be, where you want to register your business, which is completely separate to where you live, to where your kids are being educated, to where you go to the grocery store. And I'd love to see a world like that. I mean, that would be the promise of the internet, turning us into a much more evenly distributed but yet decentralized community. And that would be wonderful to see that. I would love to participate in that.
Yeah, sure.
Terrific.
What they would call being liberated from the tyranny of place.
Yeah, there you go. I love that. Well done.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Yeah. Well, let's wrap it up a bit. Where can people find more about you?
Well, all of my stuff is on borderlessblog.com. I was very active. I have a podcast. I have a podcast and a YouTube channel. Actually, two YouTube channels, but one main one is Borderless. Borderless videos, but you can just type in Borderless in YouTube, but all the links and everything are on my website, borderlessblog.com, also iTunes, Borderless Podcast. I haven't been very active within the last year. Just been really busy with a lot of other things, but I do plan on putting out a lot more content soon. I think that a lot of the things that have happened within the last 6 months have been things that I've been seeing come down the pike for a decade. And so now it's all coming. And so now is the time to talk about it and try to help people understand what exactly is going on and how they can navigate through this. What I see is just a fundamental change in business and a lot of things and, you know, the way people live worldwide. I think we're seeing a monumental shift. And whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, this is what's going on here. So, you know, I try to look at that from an objective point of view and see what is going on and how you can get through this and navigate this transition.
That's excellent. And if somebody was looking to move into Mexico or to San Miguel, do you have resources available that would help them do something like that?
I have plenty of resources. What I would probably recommend, I mean, just honestly, although it's going to sound like it's a self-promotion, I have introduced probably 100 people or more. I have done paid introduction programs to Mexico. But what I have now, if you go to my website, you can book a call with me. And it's very inexpensive. And just because that way, there's just so many questions as far as, you know, people up there worried about whether the kids are going to go to school, where should they move, taxes, immigration. I don't know what exactly people need help with, but if people want to just book an inexpensive call, I don't do like $1,000 thing, whatever. You can pay per minute. It's like $1 a minute on Clarity, which is the cheapest you can even charge. And then that way I can point people in the right direction, because I do know a lot of people that can help you with different aspects of it, but I need to know what exactly you need to do to try to give you the another big one is health insurance. You know, I've been delving into that a lot lately, the different you can save a lot of money with health insurance. So there's a lot of different avenues that people need advice. So if people want to talk to me directly, they can do that through my website or send me an email at info@borderlessblog.com.
Wonderful. All right. That's terrific. Well, listen, thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it. I hope to be down there soon myself.
That'd be great.
As soon as the planes let you fly again, you know.
One I don't of these know days. How it is. You know, I've heard that you can come in on a tourist visa still, but I don't know how it is.
Yeah, to be honest, I think the last time I looked at the State Department, they said June the 22nd was some magic date where they were going to open up borders for regular tourism travel again. But who knows?
You can't even drive down now, huh?
Well, from what I understood, we were looking at going to Los Algodones, which is like Mexicali, to get some dental work done. And they had at one point shut the border, the U.S. border, from it was only open from 6 a.m. until 1 p.m. Each day. And it was to restrict the amount of travel coming in and out. There was always the question about whether or not when you would cross the border, whether you'd be forced into a quarantine situation. I think that's not the case right now.
But I have not heard. I've not heard of anybody being like forcibly quarantined. A friend that I know, well, it's a niece. She was in New York, and she came back here, and they told her she had to quarantine. But pretty much, she just had to, you know, she was supposed to stay inside for 2 weeks, but it wasn't enforced. So I've noticed almost nothing is enforced here, except on businesses. Some of the local governments enforce things on businesses, but you know, and none of the mask wearing or all this stuff is really enforced.
Right, yeah.
Around where I am, at least.
And they have certainly relaxed it of late. I mean, I know now that the border checkpoints are now open from 6 a.m. until 10 p.m., so a much more reasonable sort of a time. But, you know, from what I understand on the 22nd, they're reducing that sort of essential travel only to everything. So maybe at that point we'll see tourism start up again. But who knows? I mean, at this point, we're living everything day by day, and it's hard to really know. And I think living in a virtual world, as we do so much these days, is probably about the only hope we've got.
Yeah. So. And who knows? You know, they keep toying around with this idea, which is completely, you know, you can see it coming, is that, you know, the second wave or this or that, or here comes COVID-20 or whatever. As long as people will comply and go along with the stuff, and I mean, they love pulling out tricks and that people are just going to follow their orders, and they get more power and they get to more bailouts and all that. So why don't they keep kicking it, you know, keep using this trick if everybody's going to go along with it?
It feels that way, doesn't it? It does feel that we, you know, I noticed this today. A friend of mine reached out to me yesterday and said that she had been offered a $10,000 employment disaster loan or something from the SBA here in the States. And I said, have you looked at all of the rules and regulations around this? And she had not. And by the time I was just curious myself, and I went in and looked at it. And the whole thing was so full of traps and restrictions and shackles that were, you have to secure a loan of, if I remember, it was a $25,000 or more loan, you had to secure it with collateral. So you had to put up your real estate, or you had to put up your assets or your business or something. And the second that you did that, now your assets were effectively owned by the federal government. Now, you own the title, but they can audit you and determine, like, if you put your house up as a collateral for a loan and you don't paint the house, they're going to come down on you on this. It's basically they will do everything they can to control your very existence with everything that you said was... It's like, okay, I'm going to go in and get some money because I'm down on my luck. I've lost my job. I, you know, need to pay the rent. But what you're going to do is you're going to take everything from me for this. Now, I've dealt in, I'm sure you have too, and, you know, in the world of real estate, we know the difference between hard money lenders and regular lenders. And in this particular case, the federal government is acting worse than a hard money lender, not because the interest rates are high, but because the power that they're imposing, the world of restrictions, is so draconian that nobody can exist anymore. And so it's such a wolf in sheep's clothing. And in a world where it's very hard to exist in the United States without bringing in a substantial amount of money, money buys you the privileges and the freedoms and the opportunities that we all need. But to get that money when the world is living in a currency of debt is horrible. But to add to that all of these restrictions and constraints and shackles that come with obtaining that very money, that very bloodline that you need to exist, is kind of like, yeah, it's like going to a blood bank run by vampires. There's no way that anybody is going to see this in positive light a year or two from now. If anything, those are the types of day in the life scenarios that have driven me to try to bring the message that, you know, you don't actually have to be here. You don't actually have to succumb to this. If you remove the costs of living, if you remove the obligations, the regulatory framework and all of that, you can still be patriotic, American, hold a citizenship, hold your passport. You can do all of that. You can pay your taxes. Well, you got to pay your taxes. But you can do all of that, and yet still you can have some freedom in this. But you just have to be willing to step out of your local neighborhood and cross that border. And as people start realizing that, they're looking for ways. They're looking for answers, and they want to take the fear of doing it out of the equation. So I really thank you for helping that, because ultimately, in the end of the day, that's the journey that I think people are going to have to get on.
Yep. Very well put.
All right. Well, thank you again. I guess we'll leave it there, and have a great one.
Thanks for joining us for the Borderless Podcast, traveling, investing, and living beyond borders.